Tape ministry people that we're beginning. And I'm Bill Lennon. And I see some new faces here. And some faces that are new for themselves, but not... Never mind, I'm going to get in trouble with that. Some old faces here, that isn't what you want to say. I'm a clinical director of a marriage, child, and family practice in Bellevue. And one aspect of what we do is we work with sexual addiction issues and sexual deviance issues and sexual misconduct issues. And they're all really different. And I've spent some time talking about some of the differences. I'm not going to talk too much about that today. Today, I want to stress two things, and I'm going to jump right into it just because of time. I want to spend a fair amount of time talking about what we can do around the issue of this thing called sexual addiction. What are some of the treatment strategies that you see, some of the treatment strategies, and for whatever reason, whether it's interest or you know somebody that's got a problem like this or you're dealing with a problem like this yourself or whatever, that you can see, oh my goodness, there are some things that you do and interesting, and I can get some kind of a picture of that. I want to spend some time on that. The other half I want to spend some time on is the issue of if you're not dealing with these issues yourself, but some other folks are dealing with these issues, what can you do? Which is actually the more difficult of the two points that I want to talk about today. Last 2 days, I have stressed, I'm jumping into the former of my two topics now, I've stressed the idea of sexual addiction as an entity, as a disease entity with an etiology that comes out of some sexual some dysfunctional family issues and shame and isolation and secretiveness and some of those kinds of issues. And in many ways it ties very closely to alcoholism, and in many ways it doesn't. Alcoholism is a good model to look at because there are enough similarities that we can see, oh yeah, and I use that as an example because that has some familiarity to us. It doesn't stay completely with that model. And if some of the things that I'm saying, you either want to question me now or question me later, where you see, well, I don't think this part lines up, that's correct. In some cases it doesn't, and in many cases it does. It's a nice model to look at. I want to talk to you about the incredible importance of having some kind of a sense and understanding of the isolation that the offender gets into, and how a little bit more about how that happens. Before I do that, I would like to say that there are things to do about it. The person who gets caught in various forms of sexual misconduct, and in here I'm back to the levels that I gave the other day, whether we're talking about compulsive masturbation or addictive compulsive responses to going to prostitutes or numerous affairs or exhibitionism or voyeurism or frottage or whatever, that's a word that some people don't know. It means rubbing up against someone, and often that's come up a couple of times earlier that people have asked me questions, could you ever be a victim and not know you were a victim? Well, I think the question, and the answer is certainly yes, you can be victimized and not know you were victimized. What people were usually asking about in that case is, could somebody have set me up sexually and I could have been a partner and I didn't even know I was a victim? And the answer to that is yes also. But one sexual misconduct response that some people who get into compulsive sexual behavior, where the victim often doesn't know they're a victim, is touching them or rubbing against them in crowded places. And the title for that is frottage. And that doesn't make any difference, except it's all of these boundary crossing areas that I'm talking about. There are some things we can do about them, and I'm going to talk more about that today. I'd like you to have empathy for the person that gets caught in this, but not excuse them at any level. There are still choices. I'll talk some about that. When we are caught in this pattern, we are making choices. The work we do in working with people here, I'll go back to something that I've stressed all the way through, is to learn to love them, but not love their behavior, to accept them, but not to accept the behavior, to break the codependency, to call lines very clearly on the behavior. Many times the codependent partner, whether it's an individual partner as in male-male or male-female, or whether it's an institution, you know, the whole institution becomes the codependent partner and doesn't want to call the offender accountable. Many times the codependent partner does not know what's going on. Many times they do. The codependent partner does the same thing that the addict does in this sense. They either distort reality or ignore reality. Either one. And in that sense, it's a disease model for either one. Jennifer Schneider, in this book, Back from Betrayal, Recovering from His Affairs, she talks in this book about, I happen to know her, and I happen to know her husband, Bert, and they're on the circuit, and I think really doing some good. She's an internal medicine physician in Phoenix, and he's a real estate developer, and they're really working at trying to help people understand that, you know, this is a real craziness, a real sickness. But she gives one example. I don't remember if she gives it in the book, but she told us in a workshop one time about how now his particular pattern was to go from one affair to another affair to another affair, and usually multiple affairs going at the same time. Well, one thing is that gets a little tricky in our society because that's supported and condoned so much that we don't sometimes think of that as being a dependency on that. And I'm not saying that everybody that has multiple affairs has a compulsive dependency on that sexual behavior. Do you follow me? Any more than I'm saying that everybody drinks 3 beers at night is an alcoholic. Some are, some aren't. So I want to keep that point straight. But she was talking about, this lady's no dummy. I mean, she's a physician and she has a practice and she does well. And she was talking about how she had learned in terms of the cycle that one of the things that her husband, Bert, had always did after he was sexual with someone, would be run and take a shower. And they later looked into some of the psychological reasons for that, but he always would take a shower right afterwards. Said she went to his office one day, and she was sure that this had been going on and so forth and so on, and it was like 11 o'clock, and he'd left the house at about 7 or 8, and in his office he had a shower, but she'd just been in there a couple days before, and it was, she'd commented to him, because she'd gone over some part of it up where the dust place wasn't, I mean the soap place wasn't touched, it was just covered with dust. She went in and she could tell that he had just showered. And she thought, uh-oh, something's going on here. Went back and checked, there was no dust in the shower, listened to him talk to her, and totally believed him, that he hadn't been sexual with anybody, that he had not taken a shower, that she didn't really notice the dust in the shower 2 days before, and walked out of there believing all of it. And saying to herself later, I'm crazy. But, you know, there's a distortion of reality or an ignoring of reality that happens both for the person that's caught in compulsive behavior and for the person that's codependent on that. One of the things that she talks about in this book, which I think is a... I'm going to come back to that because I am jumping ahead about some of the things that the codependent partners can do. So I'll come back to the one of the things that she stresses. But I wanted to talk about not giving any excuses, but the isolation that the offender gets into. And what that does for you, if you're really paying attention to what I'm saying today, and if you really have paid attention for the last 2 weeks, it puts you in kind of a schizophrenic position, because part of you gets real mad at the person that does this, and part of you just, your heart breaks for them. And I don't have an answer for that. It's just a real paradox, because the person that's caught in this kind of behavior is a mess, and they're in an enormous amount of pain. They're also making some choices. The choices may come out of a limited range of choices because they have a distorted perception, but they're still making choices. So I don't look at any of this stuff that we do excusing any of the behavior, but I look at it to try to make some sense out of how could somebody be a loving, caring person. And I'm saying the people who are caught in compulsive sexual dependency are loving, caring people. They're not bad human beings. They're not people that, they are people that have to be confronted, and they are people that have to be stopped, and the behavior has to be challenged. But so you get into that paradox. The person who gets into compulsive sexual behavior does not want to deal with paradox, wants to deal with black and white. And part of that comes out of the isolation and the secrecy. In the Korean War, we learned psychologically some enormously sophisticated, we didn't learn them, the Koreans learned them. And it's funny because the word brainwashing comes from an example that I'm going to give you. And the word brainwashing gets used in 1,000 different ways. And what it really means was a strategy that that the Koreans learned to isolate our soldiers who were prisoners. And it was a fairly simple strategy, and they used it. And since that time, even in Vietnam, we learned to counter that strategy. But now I want to tell you, there was one psychiatrist that interviewed every GI that came out of Korea that could, that wasn't too physically unable to. And he interviewed them in Japan, and he did some enormously interesting studies. And let me give you some statistics first. Not that war or prisoners of war are ever a pleasant experience, but in the Korean War, there was less torture. There were less bad conditions on our soldiers than in any war. The conditions for prisoners were much more horrendous in the Civil War. Here in our country, they were much worse in Vietnam. They were much worse in the Second World War, like the Bataan Death March and all of the horrors that went on. I'm not saying in Vietnam or in the Second World War that things were pleasant for prisoners, but they were, or in Korea. But in Korea, generally speaking, they were fed better. But one of the things happened that was statistically phenomenally interesting. The ratio of guards to prisoners in the Korean War was much, much, much lower. There were prisons in Korea where they'd only have like one guard to, I think it was 27 men or 35 men. Whereas in other wars, and particularly in Vietnam, the guard ratio was like 1 to 7 or 8. Well, see, that makes a whole lot of difference when you're fighting a war, because you can have all the rest of those guys up shooting our guys. So they liked that. What they did was a diabolical strategy, which has something to do. You can say, what in the world has that got to do with sexual addiction? But stay with me, it's coming. You would go in group in the morning and in group in the afternoon. Now, I don't know if somebody ever, I was not a prisoner. I was in the military in that time, but I was never a prisoner, so I didn't know. But this is what the psychiatrist said in his survey. And what they did was a fairly simple kind of strategy. They'd get you in groups of 8 or 10 or 12 or 15. And before you got to go to eat or to go out to exercise or do anything, what you were asked to do was just tell some of the bad things that you'd done in your life. Times that you'd stolen things, times when you'd taken advantage of people, times when you'd ripped people off, times when you'd done dirty, mean, rotten, sneaky, terrible things. And as soon as you told some dirty, mean, rotten, sneaky, terrible things, and as soon as everybody else told some dirty, mean, rotten, sneaky, terrible things, everybody got to go eat lunch. Well, you know, it didn't take long before you didn't trust anybody in there. And it takes two people to escape. And you didn't trust these guys, because hour after hour, day after day, month after month, you heard rotten, terribles, even if they made them up. But you didn't discuss them, because the more they did this, the more you isolated from them. There was another statistic that was phenomenal in Korea, And that statistic was, the closest thing they could come up to it was the marasmus response in infants. Infants that we learned this back in the 30s, that if you don't pick infants up and hold them and caress them, they die. GIs died in Korea at a higher rate than in any other war we've ever had. They didn't even have a word for it. The psychiatrist called it give-up-itis. They would go over in the corner, pull a blanket up over their head, 24 to 48 hours, they'd be dead. At a higher rate than anybody in a war. The isolation was incredible, what it did to them. Phenomenally successful strategy for the Koreans, because then they didn't have nearly as many, like they'd have one guard for 30, 40, 50 people. But nobody ever tried to escape. I mean, I won't say nobody, but it was a rare occurrence. Now, this is not what we're here to talk about today, but in the Vietnam War, the reason the tortures were worse is because we altered our code of conduct, and everybody went in, whether they believed it or not, got a lot more rah-rah of no matter what they tell you, you just say, and you don't isolate, you make contact with other people. And, you know, we worked at making sure that our people that went in fought against being isolated. And anyway, that kind of isolation is what the sexual addict feels. And that's not to make that okay, but the dysfunction that's come about is in that isolation, what he's learned is, or what she has learned is, and I don't know what the statistics are, because I've said to some of you before in the last couple of weeks that with females we have skewed statistics because not as many females come into treatment and we're not as harsh. The laws don't arrest females for some of the same things they arrest males for. You know, we joke, but we don't joke, and we say, I work with female exposers, but how many people ever arrest a female for exposing themselves? We arrest a male for exposing himself just that rapidly, but we don't arrest, you know, there's a lot of things that we handle differently. So when I say males, I work more with males, but I don't think that means that they're this kind of isolation and self-nurturing comes only with males. I don't believe that at all. But that has to be broken, and I've pounded to death for 2 weeks that one of the ways you break that isolation is to break secrecy. One of the attempts to self-nurture, self-medicate through lust versus through chemicals versus through something else is this dysfunctional attempt at sexual behavior. And what happens sometimes is there, I talked about the cycle of preoccupation and going into the ritual. When the compulsively dependent person gets into the ritual, there is a sexual high. And the ritual may be to begin cruising, to maybe thinking about driving around to pick somebody up. It may be to be walking to peep in a window. It may be to think, I've spotted a book and I know that later I'm going to masturbate. It may mean a whole lot of things, but there is kind of a high about that which tends to not be as fulfilling when the actual act is consummated. But that gets a little tricky, because even though it's not fulfilling, and even though it never works to fulfill the intimacy needs, and I've consistently said this is a disease of deep personal contact and need for intimacy, that gets a little hard to understand, because an orgasm or an ejaculation does have a strong good feeling to it. So it's a little harder to recognize that there is an emptiness there. The way you mostly recognize it is that you compulsively go back to it, and you want to get it again, and you want to get it again. And it really doesn't fulfill you. But it's not as easy to say, I believe that the ritual is more exciting than the act. But sometimes that gets a little bit confusing because of, as I said, the orgasm or the ejaculation. What has to happen for the person who's caught in the offending behavior is, and when I say caught, I'm I mean either caught as in confronted or caught up in it, know they're dealing with it. A number of things have to happen. We talked about the core beliefs. The four core beliefs have to shift. And I think that's pretty tough to do. I've talked 2 or 3 days about the belief that I'm not a very adequate human being, even though I may scramble and try to overcome, that I'm not, that I can't tell anybody my secrets because they'll never love and accept me, that I can't really depend on anybody else. And the bottom line, when I get in real trouble, sex is where I have to turn for my fix. I have to do that. Those four core beliefs need to go from over here to over here. And I don't know how to do that except in a group. So one of the first things that I recommend is some kind of AA group. And if somebody's in treatment with us, or if they're not in treatment with us, I always look at getting in some kind of an AA group. Now what happens in a Sexaholics Anonymous group, and even if you couldn't bring yourself to go to there, this is the SA book. It's $11 at any AA you can find about. There's an older SA book that I like a little better. I'll tell you the reason I like it better. They've taken the initial story about one particular guy's story. It was about 8 or 9 pages long, but you can always get a hold of one of those. And I think that was a really good story, in that what he stresses in that story is his 20, 30 years of addiction. And what you get real clear in that story is the loss that he had of losing his friend, his addiction. Because when something has nurtured you for 10, 20, 30 years, you got some real grieving to go through to lose that friend. And it's not easy. And so that's what happens in programs a lot. There's a lot of relapse difficulty, because here we bring people into program, and I'm talking about, they will always be in an SA group in our program too. But we bring people into program, and the first thing we ask them to do is go 120 days of celibacy. That sometimes becomes a joke. Or we also ask them for sobriety and abstinence, and I'm using those words synonymously. Actually, I mean celibacy and abstinence. I got my lines wrong here. Let me speak a little bit about that. When we get somebody into treatment, before they come in, we say several things. One of the things we want you to do is get into some kind of an SA, in some kind of a 12-step group. Now, I believe that's important because there's a group there, and in a 12-step group, I'm going to make a statement about it, and if this statement doesn't hold true, either because you've never been to one and you go visit one and this doesn't hold true, then I'd say leave. Or you have been to one, you say, well, that's not the way they do it, then I'd say you went to the wrong one. And that is, there's total acceptance of whatever you say. They even structure it to keep from crosstalk, so that you tell your story and it's going to be a place where you can tell anything. There's total acceptance to it. And I think that's tremendously important, that you have a place where you can go. Other folks there, and you can't go to an AA meeting because although 60 to 70% of the AA folks, alcoholics, are dealing with sexual dependency also. We know this from inpatient programs. That's not what you're there to talk about. So you won't talk about it. Your specific, get this garbage out, talk about it. Now, one of the differences in a treatment program and in an AA program, and I want people to have both, is in both you've got group, in neither one is anybody going to say, you did what? Because if they do, the rest of the folks, that's one place where the chairman of the meeting or somebody's going to, there's no place for that here. But you're going to get an acceptance, which is absolutely imperative to begin breaking that kind of distance, that kind of secrecy. The difference in a therapy group and in an AA group, and I want everybody to have both, is that there's going to be confrontation. It's going to be caring confrontation. Nobody's going to hit anybody, but there are some people going to say, bullpucky, you're crazy. You're thinking stinking. That's just not the way it is. So the guy that comes in, and I'm giving you extreme and shocking examples, but the guy that comes in and says, yeah, I go to the library and I get to the public library and I'll find some attractive young woman. And I can tell, I can look in their eyes, the ones that want me to expose myself. I know that women that really like that. Yeah, that's crazy. And I'll sit there and I'll unzip my pants and then I'll tap them and they'll look and they really get excited. No, wrong. In an SA group, nobody will challenge that. In an SA group, nobody should challenge that. In a therapy group, somebody's going to say, you're nuts. Now, we like you. We want you here. We're going to work with you. But that's part of that distorted thinking because they don't like that, Charlie. They're not interested in that. That either frightens them or, you know, so forth and so on. Well, I'm not going to take any more time on those kinds of examples. But some of the things that we do if someone is coming into therapy, I want to get across a triage idea. And I talk to people about behavior. How is your behavior going? Are you repeating the behavior? Are you beginning to break the patterns? Are there beginning to be changes? Because if you can go and get some of these books and make the changes, hey, more power to you. Hope and Recovery. It's a 12-step program for healing from compulsive sexual behavior. There's wonderful stuff in this book. It's a workbook. It'll talk about you and your partner. And if you can take that on your own and go once a week to an SA meeting, I think that's great. Buy that book for somebody. Give it to them. Help them out. And if the behavior begins to change, that's great. I encourage reading Karn's book, Out of the Shadows, which just to get information. And the book that I recommended, and they've got it up here in the bookstore up here. If there's somebody that you're really concerned about, I'd have them get this book or get it for them and say, look, I care about you and you care about me, and I want you to read this book. Even if you don't do anything else, read this book and let's chat about it if you'll do that. Because it's really got some confrontive / supportive, there's a way out kind of hope in it. Now, you can't make somebody read the book, but I really encourage that kind of thing. But when I say a triage, if someone can go on their own, get that kind of thing started, and make the changes, more power to them. If they can't do that, then the next step up in my mind is they go to an SA group and they also get into a therapy group. And we have therapy groups, for instance, that are an hour and a half a week and everybody can't commute from Dubuque, Iowa to Bellevue, Washington. I know that. But we're not that atypical in what we do in working with sexual dependency. We do an hour and a half group, or some people do a 2-hour group a week. And along with that, those two things may be enough. And I put the SA hotline. This is not Sexaholics Anonymous. This is the Golden Valley Health Center. And I've done a lot of training there. And I know that at this 800 number, I don't want you to confuse that with SA. There isn't a national SA hotline, but in most cities, you can call Alcoholics Anonymous and ask them what their SA number is and find out what the SA groups are. In Seattle, there's probably, in Seattle, Tacoma area, there's probably, with an AA meeting, I bet you can find an AA meeting morning or night every day of the week. With an SA meeting in Seattle, Tacoma, you can probably find right now about 20 SA meetings. But there's at least one every night somewhere. Between Seattle and Tacoma. I'm using that as an example. And in Seattle, Tacoma, it's just not that big a deal. And I don't think SA has a number in Seattle, Tacoma. But you can call the AA number and get the SA number. But what these people will do at least is tell you, and two or three people have asked me this, well, I'm from, at least the people that have been trained at Golden Valley, who I know have some comparison with the stuff I'm sharing with you, it's different, but at least they'll tell you in your city who they have that's trained in that area. So you've got two resources. You've got an SA group that you can get a hold of through the AA group, and there's hardly a city that doesn't have some AA groups. And you've got this national hotline. Just don't confuse the two of them. But when someone gets into treatment with us, what we will do in the first two or three meetings, we will say, look, we're dealing with an addiction, so the first thing we have to do, and I've said some of this to some of you before, but I'll stress it again, when you're doing this thing called regular counseling, whatever that is, therapy stuff, I see it as we spend some time in an open-ended kind of thing, and we interact, and we share, and we talk, and maybe this happens pretty quick, but we develop relationship, and somewhere down in here, the client and the therapist can get to a point where behavior change begins to happen. And that may take one session, or it may take 1 week, or it may take 1 month, but you know, you get some kind of closeness where you kind of open your ego up and it doesn't feel good to you, but you and your therapist and they kind of suggest you try something different. Well, we're talking about an addiction, so it's got to go the other way. I tell people, we change the behavior right now. You know, you've come because you're either at a high bottom where things have fallen apart some, or you're at a low bottom where everything's fallen apart. And there's some things you're going to have to do right now. You don't ask. And then gradually, hopefully, we build the relationship. You follow me? Because with addiction, you don't have the time to build all that stuff. And when people get into treatment over and above the AA stuff, there's been some kind of destruction that's gone on, which will say, you're right. I got to get into treatment. I got to listen to what those folks say. There's some kind of cost that's become high enough. Now, we ask them when they come in right away. One thing is we'll say, we want 120 days of celibacy. Over and over, if anybody's honest with me, they'll say, you got to be kidding. If I could do 120 days of celibacy, I wouldn't be here. I mean, I haven't done 120 days of celibacy in 30 years. I don't know what. How could I do that? There's a guy that I worked with a few years ago who I'll call Tom, and his issue happened to be compulsive masturbation, which at times when he got crazy, on two occasions he'd gone to prostitutes, and a lot of times he'd gone to arcades, but basically it was compulsive masturbation. He'd gone to seminary, he'd never taken a call in a church because he felt too ashamed. He said, I can't be a minister. I've never conquered this thing. How can I? So he's a carpenter. Which in a way is fine, but it's kind of a loss, isn't it? When he had a whole dream of doing something. But he said, the last time I didn't masturbate multiple times in a day was when I was, an eighth or ninth grader, and they were at a Christian camp, and he said, they were on us all the time, and the walls were paper thin, and there were four people in a bedroom, and the stalls didn't have doors in the bathrooms. And he said, I went 4 or 5 weeks without masturbating, and that was eighth or ninth grade. And when I worked with him, he was probably 38, and he said, there has not been a period of more than a day or two that I haven't compulsively masturbated since then. When he quit working in our program, he'd had two slips in 18 months. Of course, a lot of it was, in his case, breaking the secrets with his wife. And being very open and making enormous changes. But that's a wonderful success story. And he's not even sure now that he's not going to think about going back into the ministry. Because see, now he's kind of not carrying that load. He's not sure. But it was just a wonderful freeing kind of thing. When we ask for people to go to 120 days of celibacy or abstinence, what that forces to happen is you have to get into the 12-step concept of one day at a time. Because you can't do 120 days if you've never been able to do 120 days. Maybe what you can do is one day. Maybe what you can do is 2 hours. Maybe you can make it through the meeting. We have a joke, there's one guy who has a little bladder control problem in one of the groups, and I hope you don't take this as too raw, but he'll get up and go to the bathroom and he'll come back and say, well, I didn't masturbate, guys. And he can make it through a meeting. He's got the difficulty of he owns his own business, and owning his own business gives him a lot of free time. And so One of the little axioms that we kind of play with is, not an excuse, okay, but an axiom, high stress, low structure, and opportunity, bam, here we go. So you take the person that gets promoted into a position, they've had to check in and run the clock and do different things, and they get moved up where there's much more stress, and now they're out on the road and there's nobody to be accountable to, so they've got higher stress than they've ever had. You know, and you work up through the business and whatever, and now you're in a position where you really don't know how to do it, but you're getting paid more money and you're supposed to know more what you're doing. You're scared half to death, and you've got much more opportunity for free time. And boy, sexual addiction sometimes just comes charging out at that particular point in the person's life. But by going for the 120 days of abstinence and so on, see, all kinds of things happen. It becomes a come into group and make an immediate report about it. Well, that's breaking secrets. We do turn-in sheets where we break secrets. We've got two pages where we ask detailed questions every day. You do journaling. You do all that kind of stuff. So you're thinking about it. You're talking about it. You're being open with it with that small core group. And I've never seen anybody do 120 straight days. What we ask for is in the alcohol model, if you were to look at the alcohol model, here you are drinking and drugging. And you go through detox, and most people are sophisticated enough to know today that because you've gone through detox doesn't mean the problem's over. You go through detox, it means you've got it out of your system, and now we're ready to start to work. But we look at this as a detox period of crazy thinking. Remember when I said a little while ago that you get into a real craziness in your thinking and you either ignore reality or distort reality? Well, part of that comes in the alcohol. This is where the alcohol model stays the same. You know, you can't reason with a drunk. It just doesn't make any sense. They don't hear you until they begin to get dry. That makes some sense to you? But when you're toxic with lust, and I'm using some of our jargon words, you don't think clear either. You don't realize, you know, this is going to cost you your marriage. This is going to cost you your job. This is going to, well, no, it really isn't, or I'm not going to get caught, or it isn't that bad, or, you know, there's always these kinds of reasons. So we ask for this detox period. And we give people lots of little stories like what I'm saying now. It is possible. It's not going to be easy. They come into group and we have a check-in period and you talk about your sexual behavior. And I structure the groups very carefully. Irving Yalom taught us all about that, that we'll have seven or eight, nine people in the group. We'll have two or three old-timers that have got a couple of good years of sobriety. And we'll have two or three people in the middle and we'll have two or three people that are just struggling. But nobody gets through this 120 days easy. This is not easy to do. My world's record was, I've had a guy do 119 days and then break sobriety. Now you know, come on, you know that he was breaking it on purpose. And he knew it, but he just couldn't help himself. So he had a script to not succeed and he had some other reasons. But 2 weeks is white knuckle fairly easy, but boy, 2 weeks to a month somewhere in there, it's like it gets so tough. And then we get into all of the different strategies to help them get over that thing. Part of it is this, and I don't know what else to say. It's metaphysical, it's something. You have to get the 12-step concept. And here I just defer to the 12-step folks as, and we don't have a 12-step program, per se, but I really believe in the 12-step concept. You have to get the idea of turning it over to God and saying, God, this is unmanageable, it's out of control, it's not humanly possible, it's not me possible, I can't do it. I can't do it. Now, I can snap my rubber band, I can journal, I can read, I can make 3 telephone calls, because we ask them to do all those things. But I can't do this one. It's too much for me. I've got to turn it over. And in that sense, this kind of program becomes a spiritual program, because who are you going to turn it over to? I mean, if you don't have a concept of a higher power or of Jesus, or, and if it's too vague, you got to be kidding. I don't know how to turn it over to some. I have a friend who believes in trees, or he doesn't believe in trees, but he's a pantheist, and I said, I can't turn it over to a tree. I can't do that. You know, that doesn't work for me. But there are times when you have to come to that. And see, somebody who's compulsive has a difficult time doing the piece that I'm saying now. You have to turn it over to whoever your higher power is. And to do that, it gets you into a paradox. And people that are compulsive in their sexual behavior don't want paradox, can't stand paradox. Paradox drives them crazy. You see, what they know is, I know how to get a fix. I know how to feel better. It's black and white. If I do this, I will feel better. Turning your unmanageability over to God, that's a paradox, because you don't really know how God's going to do it. You just got to get out there on that limb and say, this is unmanageable for me. And in that sense, it's a spiritual program. And I don't see anybody getting there without accepting that piece of it. Now, there are ways that we help people get there. We structure the groups. We have people confront when you're getting into crazy thinking. But we got people supporting like crazy when you're going through the difficulty of it. It becomes an athletic event. How many days you got? You know, did you get it through 2 weeks? Come on, it's been 17 days three times now. What are you looking at for the weekend? Is there some difficulty you're going to face? As another almost metaphysical kind of thing, and I don't know why this works. I just know it works. When you pull 119 days, and you've had 119 days of celibacy, abstinence, celibacy, but something happens inside you. You may have made it in spite of the group, but you know you can do it. And I've had people tell me over and over, I haven't done that in 20 years. You know, and you hate it, and you scream, and you holler, and you say it's stupid, and I like everything about this program, but that dumb celibacy, I won't do it, and it goes on and on and on. But there's kind of a hardening that happens, a power that grows inside. Our theory about it is, and I don't let anybody off of it, everybody in our program that comes in voluntarily has to do this, and everybody that's court ordered has to do this. And we just tell them, if you're not going to do it, you might as well not come and spend your money here, because this isn't going to work. It's an integral part of what we do. But what happens is, we work people like this. We say there's sobriety and there's celibacy. Celibacy is time limited. I can't tell you never to do that act again. That's not possible. I mean, that's overwhelming to somebody to say you will never do what that compulsive sexual behavior is again. But you can do it one day. Or maybe you can do it 1 hour. Maybe you can get through group, you know, and get that. So now you've incorporated a different, I don't know what else to say, but metaphysical kind of peace, because you know now that I can make it through a day at a time. I can even make it through sometimes a week at a time if I go to two or three meetings. And that can stretch out to 120 days. But I'll tell you, there's nothing magic about 120 days. I don't know why. Actually, I've talked to a number of sex therapists about that, because we've done this with teenagers too. And you know, sometimes when you're 17 years old, you turn on to everything. And so we didn't know if it was possible for a 17 or 18 year old to do this. But I talked to a psychiatrist who does a lot of this work in New York City with a lot of kids. And she said, yeah, you can do that. I mean, it can be. It gets a choice, and you can make that choice. Not easy. For males, you won't swell up and explode. The testosterone only produces, there's only so much sperm produced, and it fills up and it stops. Now, I'm not saying there isn't some pain sometimes, but it won't kill you. I've talked to too many docs about it. I've got docs in the program. We'll say, no, that's not really an excuse. You know, a lot of guys used to have this line. Maybe they still have the line. I don't know. But when you were 16 or 17 and you were hugging and touching too much and you begin to get in some amount of pain and you use that as a line that we have to be sexual because I'm in so much pain, no, wrong. You know, that That may work as a line, but it doesn't kill anybody. It really has, nobody has ever died of that. But the idea is that in the 120 days, you learn the difference between healthy sex and dysfunctional deviant sex. Now, that's an important thing to learn, because I've said throughout these workshops, for instance, masturbation, I don't see as deviant or bad, but for some people, if it's part of their cycle, and they have to learn whether that's bad for them. Now, I'm differing from SA right there, because SA will say masturbation is never okay. I don't say that it's never okay. I say it's not okay if it's not okay for you. If it kicks you into a pattern that takes you to some bad places, then it's not okay for you. I don't think it's bad in and of itself. And as you separate that, then, in theory at least, you keep going with sobriety. And you maintain that forever. But celibacy, you stop. So what you've done is, in chemical dependency, when you go through detox, you quit bringing the chemical inside you. In our detox, you spend 120 days arguing, screaming in group, wrestling, saying, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. I hate it, and I'm never coming back again. And then somebody says, well, what night do you want me to call you? Because it sounds like you're not handling this one too well. You know, and we just get in, all right, I'll be back. And actually, the guy that did the 119 days has had such a difficulty with that thing. He did 87 days, he did 119 days. He's bound and determined he's not going to succeed. But we're going to help him there. He's not done with that yet. Sobriety, now you've separated out. You get a little better handle, and you get thinking clearer when you're doing no sex at all. So a number of things happen. One is that you learn. I can do no sex. I didn't know I could do that. Second is you learn, what's the difference between bad sex for me and good sex for me? And then you can begin to work that. You can also, in your report program, I've said to a number of you, you have three groups, and this outside group you don't tell anything about unless you have to, unless it comes up. And this group, you tell them some things, but you don't give them detail. And this group, you tell them everything. Or they just know everything. And there's a slip. Maybe masturbation is part of your pattern that kicks you into a bad cycle. So you slip. So you report that to somebody. That does not become secretive. You report that to somebody. Not to everybody, but you know, that becomes part of your breaking your secrets. And you're no longer doing celibacy. That is a sobriety break. That's like for an alcoholic taking a drink. I want to shift to this little... let me shift over to here. We do a lot of exercises like this, and I'm going to just give you two or three examples of things we do in group, partly because I want people to think, you know, I think if I really worked with that, or someone I care about really worked, that could really be helpful, I could see. The main thing is that it's in a group context, and it's in an intimate context. It really is. It's got to be pretty intimate when you come in, you're talking about, the task is to talk about what goes on with you sexually. Other thing is, you have to learn to develop skills to be intimate. Now, Holden Village, I think, does a lot of intimacy building anyway. But a lot of where I run around in my life doesn't do a lot of intimacy building. I don't mean that up here at Holden you talk about sex necessarily, but I think you're freer to get intimate with people quicker. And I think that's incredibly important. I tell people in our group, I want you to learn the skills of being intimate rapidly, and really do that. But I don't care if you're buddies with these people. I don't care if you run out and shoot pool and play cards and play Monopoly every night. But learn to be open with certain groups of people and learn that kind of intimacy, because this whole thing is a disease of intimacy. One of the exercises we do is we'll hand out a sheet of paper. I went over to Xerox it for you, but the Xerox machine was broken, and it was one that I forgot. It's just a little exercise we use. It's a sobriety exercise. And you list, and then we hand these out, and we talk about them the next week in group. You list in three columns. These behaviors I see helpful to my growth as a sexual person. For instance, talking to more people, sharing more of the rest of my life. not necessarily my sexual stuff, touching more. Because growth as a sexual person is invariably, everybody I work with that has this problem doesn't touch enough. I'm not talking about genital touch, I'm talking about touch. So figuring out some ways to get touched more in appropriate kinds of ways. So you make a list there, and then the group kicks them around, and if seven or eight people are looking, somebody says, well, yeah, that would be helpful for me too, I hadn't thought about that. So there's a sharing of that. These behaviors are part of my addiction. Abstaining from them is part of my program. Now that differs with different people, but one of the themes I've been talking about all through the last 2 weeks is that in my isolation, I don't have any good perspective of what is normal and what's not normal. I don't know what's really bad for me to do and what's not a bad thing, but it's okay for other people. So we talk about that, so I get a list here. And any of these behaviors mean a break in sobriety for me. That means I got to have a new sobriety date, I got to have a new birth date, I got to start working all over, and we look at exercises like that. Another thing we do is, because I want to work here, that we got to start break the pattern right away. Within the first time I see somebody, at least the second, but usually the first, I'll have them walking out wearing the badge of honor. That's our big fat rubber bands that we have people wear. And they say, now don't, this isn't the scarlet letter up on your forehead. You could wear a rubber band for a lot of reasons. And I try to tell people, I believe that, because you can use thought-stopping techniques for other things other than having compulsive sexual behavior. So if somebody asks you why you're wearing a rubber band, saying, I'm working on breaking some habits. But I want people to wear the rubber band. Now there's three or four reasons why I want them to wear the rubber band. And remember, I'm into this mode now. Somebody's come in, and I don't want them to walk out of the office thinking, well, that's kind of neat, those are kind of neat ideas, but what do I do about it? The rubber band, I want people to understand that there are some thoughts that lead into the sexual behavior. And the minute the thoughts come into your mind, take that rubber band and pull that hummer out and snap it. It hurts. It really does. And welts get up there, and it kind of hurts. Now, there's several reasons why I want people to do that. The addict is always most active in passivity. Okay? When you're snapping a rubber band, you're not being passive. You're doing something about it. You're, to use the AA wording, you're working your program. So, you may have had 9,647,238 deviant sexual thoughts. So it may take a whole lot of snaps of that rubber band to begin to balance that. But at least right now, as of this day, I'm working my program. I got a thought coming in, wham, I'm snapping my rubber band. So it's a self-esteem builder. It's pairing pain with the deviant thought. And we ask people to do something else. Remember, I've talked earlier, and this isn't fair to you that haven't heard me talk about this stuff, about it getting into an altered state of consciousness when you begin to get in your ritual. It's crucial to break your ritual. So what we teach people to do, and some people get just religious about this, and some people take it with a grain of salt, and I tell them, well, how much bang you want to get for your buck? You know, it's your program. So I'm always kidding about that. They always say, you cost too much. And I'm saying, well, how much do you work the program? Do it all and you'll be done quicker. But I ask people to do this. Three things. Identify the thoughts that you know that we work on in the 120 days of celibacy. Identify the thoughts that you know are not good thoughts for you. As you identify the thoughts, do three things and get it to the point where you do it all the time. In your head, say stop. Snap the rubber band and get up out of your chair and move. See, all those are meant to break the altered state of consciousness, because you can move into this kind of thing and you don't, and boom, you're doing it again. And so, stop, snap, move, stop, snap, move, stop, snap, move. And I can't get into a person's head, and I don't know if they do that or not. I say, that's just always my line. How's your program working? Are you working it? Or somebody gets mad at me because I'm not doing enough for them, and I say, I can't walk around, I can't get in your head. But that's a tool that we can give somebody. And we give them that tool real early. we have people do this kind of thing, and it's a specific and it's a construct as well. I have people, and we're sitting around in group, and so we're talking about this kind of stuff all the time. Hopefully lightly, and there's got to be a little levity, because this stuff can get so heavy, it can just be crazy sometimes. So we make a list of behaviors. What are the behaviors that you can think of that play into your sexual acting out? Everything that might have something to do with it. And people help each other. And if we had time today, we had 3 hours, we could let you have anonymity and we could get a whole list here. I mean things like, I'm standing at the 7-Eleven and the clerk has let the little cover for all the pornographic magazines, Penthouse and everything, left the thing open and I can see some pictures, and that's exciting to me. Or a fellow told me, I'm giving you different kinds of examples, he went into a Denny's restaurant and at a certain hour of the morning they quit serving breakfast. And he was pretty sophisticated. This was a guy who was in multiple relationships. And he took that as an affront to him, because if a woman wouldn't do what he wanted to do, he had to do one or two things, either get a conquest or go masturbate. And so then he would move into a mode of trying to get her to serve him breakfast. He didn't even really want breakfast, but to be able to be shut down was like a put down to him. And so he would get into that particular kind of mode. Or you didn't make a sale that day. So I'm trying to give you examples of very low-level kinds of things or very intense kinds of things. But so we list them all, and then after we list them, we ask people to, and we help each other. We go to small groups, 2 or 3, put them in some kind of linear order. And you can't, I got too many scribbles up here, but this is what we call a snake. And I didn't make it up as snake. I mean, when I made the exercise up, I called it a snake, and I think that's kind of interestingly symbolic, isn't it? But we put lines on the snake, and this is the act, and we list the act. The act is to touch a child. The act is to kiss a client sexually. The act is to take a parishioner of mine and take them for a walk and hold my arm around and touch their breast. The act, you know, whatever the act is, we put the act down here. And then we put in a linear kind of way, and it often takes several weeks to get this built, the snake. Everything that led up to that act, starting with very low-level kinds of things, because there are days for the compulsively dependent sexual person who could have those bad things happen and wouldn't lead into the act. And there are days when it kicks you right into the act, and you know, we don't. So we got to take a look at that. So we list all these behaviors, and these I call low-level behaviors. These are things didn't go well, or my wife yelled at me, or somebody didn't do good at work, or, you know, whatever. And it builds all into, and then I try to get them to say, now keep remaking the snake. And we do a lot of this during the 120 days of celibacy, because people are beginning, it's like levels are falling off and they're seeing things more clearly. And it's interesting. I'm throwing so much at you guys, I can't imagine how you stay with me, but it's like when people really start losing weight, if you're really going to lose weight, I used to do a lot of weight reduction stuff, what happens is you start getting real angry and real emotional and real upset because the weight is kind of a barrier. Well, the same thing happens here. You start feeling a lot more as you're going through the 120 days of celibacy. So you're a lot more angry and you're a lot more upset. You're also a lot more at risk to relapse and go back into the thing. And so you really have to get a lot of good sleep and not be in a lot of tense situations and those kind of, as you're getting your recovery going strong. But we make that list. Then we take that same list and we put it on this kind of graph paper right here. And I ask people to divide it into 3 levels. Can you see I want to translate this list to this list? And I say, here are low-level behaviors. List the behavior. What do you do? Then I have these little marks here. How did you feel when you did that? Because when you're into your cycle, you don't feel anything. You're just into it. Could you feel? And then what are 3 things you could have done to stop it? Well, I could have called a friend. I could have read a book. One guy told me, I could have gone fishing. I said, oh, have you got the boat? Are you ready? Well, no, but I could. Don't kid yourself. You know, when you really start getting into your cycle, you got to have stuff ready right there. You got it. So we work a lot on things you could do, three things you could do about it, and listing and relisting. And we make snakes, 10, 15, 20 snakes, different scenarios that could kick you into your paddock. That takes a lot of time to do that, and talking in group about it. But we talk about it in three levels, one, two, three. And I look at that like the roller coaster thing, and I say, I am absolutely convinced if you spend this time working, you get a pretty good handle on where your head's at. And you know what your feelings are, and you can learn at the bottom third of your cycle. Once you understand your cycle real well, you can step off the roller coaster. And you can begin to do some of the things, like you can start journaling. You can call somebody who knows your stuff that's going on. That particular guy that I said that quit masturbating after, you know, junior high and everything, he had gotten to the point where his wife was enough a part of this, not in a codependent way, that he would call her if he got into some stuff. Now, that could be a misuse, but she agreed to do that, and he'd give her a call, and he'd say, I'm remodeling a house, and they've got some magazines here, and they're going to be tough for me. And once he'd done that, then it wasn't tough for him. See, because the secret was broken. But if he didn't do it, he'd be trying to work and trying to hammer and remodel, and he'd be thinking about, but up in their bedroom, they've got a bunch of magazines. I want to go look at them so bad. Do you see what I'm saying? So he would take some active steps. He'd take them at the bottom third. We say, you've got an excellent chance of breaking the pattern if you're snapping rubber bands and calling people and working your program and journaling and doing these kind of things at this level. Here it gets iffy. I don't know. We also do some meditative exercises, and I'm not throwing in everything, but here it gets iffy. And my guess is that by the time you get up to here, you're so much into the cycle, that by the time you hit this point, you're probably going to go through it anyway. You know, it's very doubtful that you'll stop once you get up to there. Boy, I didn't even do my other thing. Jennifer Schneider talks about, I'm going the other side of it now, if you're a partner of someone who, and she talks about this a lot in this book, and it isn't only for the ones whose compulsive behavior is in affairs. She takes this same idea, and what she does is ask people that she's working with who are in relationships.